I think we have some time for some questions. So I think if people want to raise their hands, and then we have some microphones around. I think I saw a hand up there first.
Thanks for being here today. My name is Shane Akadada. I'm the head of the Guantanamo Litigation Project.
Thank you. I was going to ask everybody to introduce themselves and identify their affiliation. Thank you.
And thanks again for being here and for hosting this. My question for you is this. The biggest obstacle to closing Guantanamo has been the Defense Department's, we believe, very inflated stats about return to terrorism among people released by the Bush administration. Their claim that almost 50 people have gone back to hostile activities, a claim which you repeated this month. Our statistics are more like under half a dozen people who've gotten involved in anything approaching criminal activity. So my question for you is, what explains the gulf? And if we don't know, would you commit to sitting down with myself and Professor Denbo, who've done a number of studies on this and all have security clearances and could do it in a classified setting, to iron out our differences in terms of individual names?
Okay, thank you. In the previous administration, I think there were about 532 individuals from Guantanamo who were transferred. And in this administration, we have transferred 48. So that brings you up to about 580. In a recent, very rigorous interagency review that looked at all intelligence sources, it was determined that the recidivism rate of those who are known or suspected to have reengaged in violent extremism comes out to 20% or so. Slightly under, believe it. Well, 20%. And that's broken down, I think it's 9.6% of those who are confirmed, and or 10.6 and 9.4 suspected. This is based on all available intelligence information. Is the number inflated? It's very difficult to get precise figures on that. People sometimes use that figure, 20%, and say, oh my goodness, one out of five detainees return to some type of extremist activity. You know, the American penal system, the recidivism rate is up in about 50% or so as far as return to crime. 20% isn't that bad. Yet we know that many of those detainees have returned and have engaged in not just extremism, but terrorist attacks. It is something that we have to look at very carefully. We have tried to put in place in this administration a more rigorous review on the transfers. There remain about 190 or so detainees in Guantanamo. Hopefully, all those individuals will be transferred or will go into prosecution either under Article 3 or military commission. I'd be happy to take your information and relay it to the people who follow this very closely. But I think it was a very thorough review. And again, it's broken down to between those known and suspected. So the number of known recidivists on terrorism is about 10%.
Yes. My name is Omar Shaheen. I'm the Public Relations Director for Islamic Relief and the Chairman of North American Imams Federation. First, I would like to thank you for your comments about Islamic Relief. We as a Muslims community, I'll be honest as always, like always, and direct to the point. We as a Muslims community, we live in this country and we love this country. Actually, this country loves on us. Muslims community, like any other community, came to this country to enjoy justice and freedom. We feel that after September 11, we are not enjoying these great values anymore. Also, we feel that there is a big lack of a trust between Muslims community and our government. My question is, there is anything being done by our government to rebuild this trust? Thank you.
I think President Obama said during his campaign and has said since his inauguration that he is determined to put America on a strong course. It doesn't mean just on national security. It means engagement. It means to return to our core values as a country. I was in the government 9/11, and it was a tremendous trauma for this country, for this government, unlike any we had ever seen before. The reaction, some people might say, was over the top in some areas. But when you wonder about other threats, and in the aftermath of 9/11, we didn't know what we were facing in terms of WMD attacks, other cells that might be out there, and in an overabundance of caution, implemented a number of security measures and activities that upon reflection now, we look back after the heat of the battle has died down a bit, and we say they were excessive. Okay? Reasonable people can disagree about that. What President Obama is trying to do, though, is now to take into account and which he does every day, optimizing the security of the American people. Every day he gets up, he wants to make sure people are safe and secure from a number of different areas, health, education, and national security. We have to get this balance right. And I'm here today to try to explain and describe how the administration sees the way forward. This is going to be tough. It really will. Because, let's face it, a lot of people will have very ignorant feelings and will have prejudices and discriminations that we have to erode. We have to constantly work every day. But this is not something that's going to be like a light switch that you can switch on and off. I think we're making a lot of progress as a nation. I don't want us to slide back. And I was very concerned after the attack in Fort Hood, as well as the December 25th attack, that all of a sudden there were people who went back into this fearful position that lashed out, I think not thinking through what was reasonable and appropriate. And so I think we have to maintain this dialogue to ensure that we don't go back to an era when we look at people with automatic suspicion, at the same time that we have to do things for our security. Let's go over here this time. Out there. Hand up. Yes. I think someone's coming with a mic.
Thank you, Mr. President. My question is more based around the youth involvement. I'm sorry, my name is Samuel Mansouri. Thank you for your remarks. And my question relates to the youth involvement with President Obama's administration. One point that he made, the President, is to go to Cairo and talk to all of the Muslims in the Middle East about what they can do to better the situation. But what about the youth in America?
In fact, I spent about 3 hours yesterday with President Obama talking about a number of issues with several other people from the White House. And we talked about the issue of global engagement and strategic communications, and emphasizing the point, we all did, that there is a global engagement strategy and requirement, but we need to make sure that we have the domestic engagement as very much a part of it. And we talked about my address here this morning and the need to continue to ensure that we're able to interact, because not just reaching out to you for the sake of our own sort of homeland security and the well-being of our country, but you and people that are represented here have your relationships and contacts and travel frequently overseas. You need to be ambassadors in your own right, in your communities, in your schools, and as you travel and interact overseas. As I said, this is hard, but it requires constant attention. And as we talked before with some of the leaders of the community prior to my remarks this morning, talked about the importance of resources being dedicated to it. And also, I will say one other thing on this issue. After 9/11, our country really responded remarkably to the attacks on 9/11. And we did amazing things to make this country safer. And this country is a much less hospitable environment for terrorists to carry out attacks here. And that's why we've been very fortunate, because of very hard work that was done. But we can't just be focusing on the finding terrorists and extremists and stopping them from carrying out their attacks. If we think about the process of extremism and becoming extremists and terrorists, it's a continuum. It starts somewhere. I like to think that everybody is born into this world with a certain amount of innocence to them. And unfortunately, sometimes as they go through life, forces of evil will bring them down a certain path. We cannot have just the counterterrorism, law enforcement, homeland security communities focusing on this, because then we're just looking at the end of the continuum where terrorism and extremism and radicalization has already taken firm root. We have to go upstream. We have to look at those issues. And we are trying to engage more and more with behavioral scientists and other things. What leads a person to join a gang? What encourages a person to start that process toward becoming a violent extremist, whether it's with a religious banner or something else? We need to address this in our systems and our societies and our communities. And so therefore, I think what we're trying to do in the Obama administration is to reach out. And the people that are here today from the various parts of the U.S. government are those representatives and those ambassadors that hopefully it's going to take root, you know. Just like the movement that led to President Obama's election, I like to think that we're going to feel this common shared responsibility for addressing our security issues. Over here. Can you wait for this? Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for taking my question. I'm Amir Al-Haj Khalid Saman from Cleveland, Ohio. I don't want to thank Paul Matero for inviting us here. I worked in law enforcement, public safety as a member of the youth gang unit for 10 years, and I served as assistant safety director in the city of Cleveland, specifically around gang intervention and prevention, and worked with several Muslim cultural specific groups that deal with prevention and intervention. And I think President Obama attended a gang summit we had back in the early 90s in Chicago. And I was pleased to hear your conveyance about strategic communication. But many of us have been involved on the ground as practitioners dealing with that kind of work. And we found that we would like to make sure that we are engaged in that strategic communication with the administration because of the experience that we have. We found that, you know, in the prior administration, that there was difficulty there, even though there had been some communication and some relationships. What I like to see, and I think I can speak on behalf of the colleagues that I work with quite closely, is more emphasis on what you just said about those that are practitioners and experts in the field who have experience and can address that issue about what transforms and what creates the kind of mentality that leads to some of the things that we have to deal with today, not only in the United States, but throughout the world.
I think your point is a absolutely right one. And it does take a village. And you know, I've looked at these issues that beguile us as a nation, whether it be on terrorism or other issues. How do you make progress against some seemingly intractable problems? And it really does take work at the grassroots level, as well as at the very strategic level. But they need to be working in concert with one another, as opposed to at odds. And I sort of equate it to, as we deal with issues of poverty or illiteracy, you need the Peace Corps approach, but you also need the World Bank approach. You need to have people who are gaining that practical experience and working with people so we understand and can make that progress on the ground. But we also need to have a strategic framework that we can ensure that we're marching together in the right direction. It is a tough challenge to try to bring that together. But the more people who are engaged in it at that grassroots level, the people who have that experience and can then transition from maybe a law enforcement career to a community engagement career or something that is going to be working with the community, I think we need more of that cross-fertilization because it enriches, I think, all of us to gain that experience. Yes, right here.
Chloe Breyer, the Interfaith Center of New York and St. Mary's Episcopal Church. Thank you so much for your comments underscoring the importance of interfaith relations, also for your work to close Guantanamo. Several of us from many faith traditions served at Ground Zero after 9/11 with the Red Cross doing chaplaincy work. Some of us, I would say, are disappointed with the way our elected officials have turned down the opportunity to have a trial for one of the people who is responsible, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And my question to you is, if what some perceive as a not in my backyard scenario, or at least and cowardly otherwise, might be turned around, is it possible we might get that trial back here in New York City?
Yes, clearly this is an issue that the people here in the city feel very strongly about. And frequently they have very different views on the issue about whether or not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed should be tried in the city. There is an obvious need to take into account a number of different factors as far as support from the local community for this, the funding requirements. There are dependencies that will determine when that trial is going to start and where it's going to start. The important thing to keep in mind is that we need to bring these people to justice. That's what this country is all about. It was such a heinous act of murder on that day when nearly 3,000 people died that we need to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to justice in an American court. There are constitutional requirements as far as venue is concerned and where he can be tried, whether it be here in New York, Pennsylvania, or Virginia. And the Southern District of New York has had, you know, tremendous experience and success in trying these terrorists. And the administration, the Attorney General, and others are trying to push this forward as best we can. But Again, the dependencies are there. Where is the funding going to come from in order to provide the necessary security? We need non-obstructionism from certain elements within the government in order to move forward on this. These are very difficult challenges, and people have frequently polar opposite views on this and feel very, very strongly about the issue about whether or not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed should be tried in Article 3 court or under military commission. I think we probably all have our own views on that, as well as where the venue should be. We're trying to work our way through it, and there are some stiff winds that are blowing that are delaying bringing this man to justice. That's the important thing. And I've had extensive conversations with people within the government, also, you know, here in New York, and I'm hoping that this is going to be resolved for the sake of the victims and their families of the 9/11 tragedy. Yes, over here. Over here, and then we'll go over here.
Hi, thank you for coming. My name is Dalia Mahmoud with the Muslim Public Affairs Council of New York City. My question, I really appreciate what you said in recognizing that Muslim Americans have been victims of prejudice and hate, those who have hate in their heart. And oftentimes that's very much fueled by perceptions in the media and by, you know, the terminology as such as, you know, war on terror and Islamic terrorism and so forth. Is there anything specifically that is being discussed currently in terms of revising that type of language and the use of it by our administration?
I think, as I mentioned in my remarks, we're trying to be very careful and precise in our use of language, because I think the language we use and the images we project really do have resonance. That's why I don't use the term jihadist to refer to terrorists. It gives them the religious legitimacy that they so desperately seek, but I ain't going to give it to them. They want that status of a sovereign state from the standpoint of enemy combatant. I believe that they should be treated as the miscreant murderers that they are. They're trying to gain that status and that image so they can rally additional support. That's why I think, and I understand the reasoning behind after 9/11, the term global war on terrorism. It tried to convey that concept of we are opposed to this as a nation, and we indeed are. And it's not that that was an incorrect term. I just don't think it was as precise as it needs to be. That's why, you know, being precise, saying we're at war with Al-Qaeda, we're at war with these terrorist groups. But I don't want our language to then lead to individuals seeing that as an extension, or then extending that to communities that frequently are represented by those terrorist attacks. They take place in Pakistan. 99.9% of the people in Pakistan abhor those attacks. However, it is that vocal, violent minority that gains the attention of the press. And whenever anything happens, the press goes right toward it, the media. And I think too frequently, the press will go with people who have that strident view, that will adopt a position on the radical fringe because that's what's going to make news. And I think that unfortunately fuels the fires. And I will give my life to make sure that the fourth estate of this country and the freedom of speech is protected and enhanced. That doesn't mean, though, that everybody who gets on a camera speaks responsibly. And that's why, and I have been forceful recently, decrying any type of misrepresentations that are put out in the press, including by politicians, that I do not accurately reflect what is happening in this country. We should not be instilling more fear in the country. Over here.
Thank you so much. My question is possible for the administration under Mr. Obama to think about how we can educate the people who are talking about religion, all of them, by having a channel of TV or radio or whatever. And the government should support this idea financially because it will help and it will cost less than the war. I have already two big book, each one about 1,000 page or less, the other one. And I was requested this during the time of 1980. I am member of Interfaith between Jewish, Christian, and Muslim in New York. From 1980, I got the position of assistant manager of the Islamic Center of New York, and I am ready to give it to your office just to take a look. Besides, I was raised in a Catholic school, French Catholic school in Egypt, where I enjoy my life between friend, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, and work at the same time for 30 years with one of the biggest French company in Egypt.
Yeah, I think you make a good point about the need for education. And the media can be one of the best mechanisms to convey the responsible and appropriate characterizations of faith and of people and goodness. Unfortunately, though, there are forces of evil in the world that we need to be able to confront continuously. That's why I think education, and I'm not just talking about vocational training or education in the sciences and literature, it's education about who we are as a people on this planet, exposing people more to the different races and cultures and identities that exist worldwide. Because I find that ignorance comes out of a lack of knowledge as opposed to exposure. The more we can expose the American people to others, I think the more progress we'll make. Let's go over here.
Hi, Mr. Byrne. Thank you for coming here, and thank you for the Islamic Center to invite just not Muslims, but even non-Muslims like myself. My name is Nikunj Trivedi, and I'm from the Hindu Students Council. My question to you is, in your remarks, you said that the president has promoted, you know, has promised to fight against negative stereotypes of different faiths. Right after 9/11 on September 23rd, I was attacked personally on campus at Rutgers because of this whole negative portrayal of various faiths. And the remark that the person actually made was, you know, you Muslims, you Hindus, you're all the same. You all come from, you know, backward India and, you know, Pakistan and stuff like that. Now, what is the administration's effort or what initiative does the administration have to include Hindu Americans in this dialogue as well? Because I think this is the first time that I've been invited here, and many of the Hindu Americans have been invited in such a great dialogue about the nation's security, because we are about 2 million strong, and like you said, just like Muslim Americans, Hindu Americans also are in various parts of the administration. So what is the administration's initiative in including Hindu Americans in this dialogue?
You're absolutely right that this dialogue has to be one that is truly interfaith and of the multiple faiths that we have within this country. Last year, Prime Minister Singh from India was the only foreign head of state who was accorded a state dinner. And it was a way to highlight and, in fact, put the spotlight on how much we and India have in common. But also, I think it shone brightly differences, but differences that, again, that are not supposed to separate us. So, you know, when I hear that it's, maybe this is the first time you're here, but we really need to be able to bring these different representatives together more often. We take pride in our identities. Again, we can take pride in the fact that we're a Hindu, a Muslim, or that we're an American or something else. But as I was mentioning in my remarks, we have these multiple identities, and we really need to emphasize that which joins us. And the people in this room, U.S. citizens, U.S. persons, whatever, or just living here in the United States, we share a common bond that we need to celebrate more often. So this is reaching out to the Hindu community, to the Jewish community, the Christian community, to the Buddhist community, and others are things that I think the president is very determined to do. He is, without a doubt, the best spokesperson for the United States government right now. He can connect with people. He's such an articulate and eloquent spokesperson. But what we need to do as a government is to spend more time in groups like this, because it's something that I think is going to, you know, catch on. I think, you know, a lot of people want to be involved, want to help to break down these walls of ignorance that separate us. I'm trying to. Let's go back there.
Thank you. My name is Bobby Khan. I'm founder of Coney Island Avenue Project. I'm a proud Pashtun, which is 6,000 years old history, and then Muslim, and then Pakistani and now New Yorker. I really want to bring up, you know, that we keep raising, you know, that here and back home too. I was raised and born and raised in Pakistan. My grandparents migrated from Afghanistan. The same you know, mistakes has been repeated, and we haven't seen any change. That's the same stereotyping, and the same criminal are being dealt, or the Pakistan Army back home, which is the collaborative in the war on terror. Those are the real terrorists themselves, and they're created mullahs and Taliban. Those are created by Pakistan Army, and here too. The innocent person like Siraj Mateen and several others, those were convicted by criminal informants just to save their skins, and that practice is still going on. And the person like us, those are called the person of interest. Whenever we go across the border and come back, we took like 6 to 7 hours. We had strip searches, and myself, my two-year-old daughter was searched. It was a hand patted search, and was told that when we raised question, we're told that your name is a person of interest, and that person of interest is fighting for democracy, for secular and progressive doctrine, for most of his life. What Obama administration is doing, we are seeing the same policies are being followed.
The administration is trying to address those policies specifically. And I think the aftermath of December 25th is probably a good discussion point, because it's a controversial one. After that attempted attack, there were 14 nations or so whose citizens were put on the list for secondary screening. And believe me, I've had a number of people and a number of foreign countries call to complain about that. And I understand their concerns. However, sometimes when something happens that shocks us from a security standpoint in an overabundance of caution, we implement certain strategies and actions that we believe are necessary to ensure the best we can the safety of American citizens. We are reviewing that process right now, and I've met with a number of foreign ambassadors and others that we are going to be recalibrating that as it needs to be now that we have a better sense of what actually happened at that day. So we're trying to address those policies the best we can to make sure that we at least have a framework that is fair, that is non-prejudicial, and that optimizes security while at the same time optimizes civil liberties. But we still are a nation of people, and policies will be implemented by individuals. And sometimes subjective judgments come into play when somebody has to apply that policy. And as we talked before, the issue of discrimination and prejudice is something that frequently is ingrained in people because that's the way they either grew up or were taught, or they come from a certain environment where that is the norm rather than the exception. And it takes quite a bit of time for that to change in an individual as well as in a community. I mentioned before that I'm a son of an immigrant. My father immigrated here from Ireland when he was about 28 years old. And you know, in the United States, for many, many years, there were signs on doors that, you know, Irish need not apply. Irish had to go through that same type of discrimination and prejudice, as did the Italians, as did Germans, Asians, others. Unfortunately, the richness of the diversity that we have should enrich us too often does separate us. And that's why I think we need to be looking at ourselves as individuals, not the way we look, or the creed we have, or our ethnic background. You have to look at us. I consider myself a citizen of the world. You know? And that's what President Obama is trying to do, make sure that we as America can interact with the rest of the world in a safe and secure way. And trying to calibrate then and balance these policies in a way, again, that optimizes national security and optimizes the opportunity for people in this country never to be profiled, never to be discriminated against. It's going to take many, many years. Back here? I'm sorry, the one behind you. Yes. We'll get you next.
Thank you. I really appreciate your remarks. My name is Layla Buck. I'm actually My mom's Lebanese. My dad was an American diplomat who was actually in Saudi Arabia, I think, the same time you were. And one of the things that I appreciate about what you said is that we need to look upstream in terms of fighting terrorism. And I have two questions. My primary question is the relationship between terrorism and our foreign policy, which we haven't really talked about. And as I'm sure you know from spending time in the Middle East, a lot of the fuel for terrorist activity and Al-Qaeda it's fueled by our support for actions that are not in keeping with a lot of the values you've been talking about, specifically in our support for the Israeli military, things like the assault on Gaza, when Arabs and Muslims see other Arabs and Muslims who are innocent civilians being attacked by a government and a military that we fund and support on a political and financial level. And I think, I understand, you know, there are many complicated international policy issues there. And I'm curious what the Obama administration's plan is and how much, I think I would say that there needs to be an addressing of our relationship with Israel and our support for their military actions as it relates to both our image and our integrity within the Arab and the Muslim world. And I'm curious what your government is doing about that.
Okay. And what your government is doing about that, too.
Yes, what our government is doing about that. And the second, and a smaller question is also, because you raised the issue of subjectivity in the implementation of profiling, mm-hmm. What steps are in place to train our TSA workers in particular in terms of a better understanding of Arab and Muslim culture so that they have something other than the fears and the stereotypes when they are implementing those policies?
Okay, 2 points there. You're absolutely right that our counterterrorism policies need to be integrated more fully into our foreign policies as a whole. I've used the term that our CT tail should not be wagging the policy dog, because if we're just addressing the terrorism threat, we're really missing how we can get to those factors and the environmental dynamics that are contributing to this. And the good examples are, look at the Horn of Africa right now in Somalia. You know, we're facing a problem as far as Al-Qaeda in East Africa, and there are sort of raging violence there, internal civil war, Al-Shabaab and others. What are we hoping to be able to accomplish with the Horn to try to bring some peace and security to Somalia? Same thing in Yemen. We're facing a problem right now with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but Yemen has some significant, you know, structural problems. A depleted water table, oil revenues that are going down. They have a Houthi rebellion in the north, southern secessionists in the south, a unemployment rate that probably hovers about 40%, the fourth greatest population growth rate in the world at 3.5%. They double every 20 years. How are you going to address those problems? Because unless you address them, you're still going to have the extremists who are going to be the products of an environment that doesn't give them the opportunity they seek. So what we've tried to do, whether we're talking about Somalia or Yemen or other places, is to make... I'm coming to that. I said I have 2 points. That's the first one. Okay? So what we're trying to do is make sure that we're able to address the other issues that we need to be able to deal with successfully if we're going to make the long-term progress. We can take out terrorists, individuals, whatever, but, you know, it's like pollution. You know, the pollutants get downstream and you start scooping them out, but unless you go upstream and start taking care of the actual polluters, you're not going to get ahead of it. So, second issue. First of all, the United States is dedicated to ensure that Israel stays safe and secure. It is a very close ally and partner of the United States, and we're going to make sure that that continues. At the same time, the President and others have underscored their commitment to make sure that there is going to be a two-state solution, and that the legitimate rights and aspirations of the Palestinian people need to be fulfilled. This is something that has vexed this government and the international community for the past 43 years now, ever since 1967, some might say before, from the late 40s. These are tough issues that the President has been trying with Senator Mitchell to continue to sort of work so that we right now have a divisive Palestinian populace between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, West Bank and Gaza. There needs to be some unity on both sides, both in the Israeli government as well as within the Palestinian area. And I think some people have the belief that we need to separate ourselves out from Israel before we can make progress on this. I don't agree with that. When I was, as I talked about being at AUC in the mid-70s, it was in 75, it was less than 2 years after the 73 war, when the United States, you know, came to Israel's rescue and pushed back then the Egyptian advance in the Sinai. And I remember very clearly walking down the street of Cairo one early morning. I used to just love walking through Cairo, the old city, city of the dead. And it was about, I think, 7 or 8 o'clock, and I could see an Egyptian, middle-aged Egyptian in traditional garb, in a galabeah, walking toward me, staring at me. And I'm looking at him, and he stops in front of me and says, "Ente Amriki al Sovieti?" Are you American or Soviet? Because the Soviet Union was the supporter of Egypt at the time. And although I wasn't well-schooled in Middle Eastern politics, I knew that, you know, the United States was not the favorite nation of a lot of folks who came to Israel's aid. And I was 19 years old at the time, and I didn't know what the right answer was in terms of being American or Soviet. And so I mustered my courage, and I said, "Ana Amriki?" And he looked at me with a big smile and put two thumbs up and said, "Mumtaz," and walked on. And I was left there scratching my head. And I went back to the dormitory and talked with some of my Egyptian and Jordanian and Palestinian dorm mates. And they said, "Well, see, John, you said you were an American, and America really stands for something. Yes, Arabs, Egyptians, Palestinians will have issue with United States foreign policy or US government actions, but America does stand out in the Middle East, in the Arab world, and in the Islamic world as being this a beacon of freedom and liberty. Remember back in the 70s when the Soviet Union was there, the United States was viewed as the bulwark against the encroachment of atheistic communism coming down. And we really did stand side to side to prevent that from happening. The United States, I think, represents a fairness that I think most Arabs and Muslims believe is innately in us, but sometimes our policies are misguided. We need to be able to address the issue of outstanding Israeli-Palestinian problems. You're absolutely right. It continues to feed this wellspring of anti-US sentiment and extremism. There needs to be movement on both sides. We need to find a resolution, whether it be territorial, we're talking about the, you know, final status arrangements. It is tough, but we're not going to separate ourselves from Israel.
We are literally funding one side of that conflict, so it's not as simple as...
There's a lot of funding going on to the other side of the conflict as well in terms of the... yes, right here. Let's get a...
Thanks for taking my question. My name is Mandeep Sabti, and I'm a guest of C Coalition. I agree with everything you've said today earlier on in your speech, and I'm like sitting here with a list of questions and everything went out the window one at a time. But I still have a basic question for you. I have a 21-year-old son. Every time he passes through a airport security line, he's pulled aside and frisked. And this is a kid who's born and brought up in this country. And I feel it's just not his predicament. It's every 20, 18, 19, 20-year-old in this room feels the same way. Even though they're born and brought up in this country, and this is the only country they know, but they feel like they are disenfranchised every step of the way. They don't feel that in New York, but as soon as you walk, you know, walk away 500 miles west of New York, you start feeling that. My question to you, and as one question, somebody asked a question earlier on, what are you doing to engage the youth? Yes, I understand, you know, the things like we are fighting the terrorists, but we have a much bigger problem at our hand. If we don't do something about this youth, who are American kids, and this is the only country they know, there's going to be a much bigger potential issue. Yes, you talked about Fort Hood gunmen, the person who killed 13 people. And America was very tolerant, and we are very appreciative of that. But I don't know how long they would stay that way. So my question to you is, And another thing that I took from you, that your father was an immigrant, just like I'm an immigrant, right? And your son of an immigrant, just like my son. What chances are for him to have the same rights as you enjoy today and going through all this climate that we are in right now?
Yeah. Oh, to have a magic wand and to wave it over this country and to allow us to be able to live without any of that prejudice or fear or profiling. And you know, some of that prejudice is willful and malicious, and some of that prejudice is born out of ignorance, and it's not malicious. Couple things. One is that, you know, when I get together with President Obama every morning in the Oval Office, and he's sitting in that chair, and I used to be in the Oval Office a lot with previous presidents, and frequently I sit there and I look at an African-American who has such a different background than any other president, who spent years in Indonesia, comes from a Kenyan father, American mother, represents that diversity in one person, who was able to not just aspire to, but actually achieve the highest office in this land. And I say to myself, yeah, that's the American dream. That allows us to think, wow, just 40 years ago, when Martin Luther King was shot down, this country has come so far as to be able to elect an individual like Barack Obama. Hopefully, your son will be able to one day either be at this podium, or your members of your family will be the person from Transportation Security Administration who will be at that queue, at the front of the queue, when people who look like you and look like others in this room come forward, and your son or your family member will smile, remembering what maybe he or you had to go through. This is a marathon. This is a journey. This is something that America's story is still being revealed, and we're going to hit speed bumps. But the thing is, we really need to be able to imbue in those that we live with and love for them to not lose hope. You know, if you lose the hope in the system, then we've lost so much. And that's what the extremists are really hoping to do, continuing to hit and pummel and pummel. And if we respond with ignorance, if we respond in a manner that is inappropriate, we just give them what they are looking for. That's where we really have to counter this narrative that they have out there. Let's take a couple more. Over there. Yes.
Thank you so much. I wanted to commend the point that you made about how we need to be precise in the language we're using. And asking this question as president of Women in Islam Incorporated and a group of community organizations here in New York who wrote a response to the NYPD's report, Radicalization in the West, the Homegrown Threat. And in our meetings with Commissioner Kelly, which he, you know, was very nice to have a dialogue with us, and I think this kind of conversation is critical, we raised a question about the internet sites. And I think as we go forward in trying to address this problem, it's very important for us to have shared definitions of what we're trying to grapple with. So how can you please explain a little bit further as to what is the construct of an extremist website, and what steps are taken or will be taken to share a list of these websites with the community? As you so eloquently put it, we will be responsible for dealing with this threat within our families and our community. And I'm asking this question also as a parent of an internet-savvy kid who knows more about the internet than I do. Thanks.
Oh boy, that's a really tough question. You know, how do you define extremism? When does it go past that line that is protected by free speech, but yet is going to inspire, agitate, encourage people to go down that violent path or carry out violent attacks? It really is tough. But I think as people who are schooled in your religions, who are schooled in what you want as a community, I think there are a number of websites out there and individuals who it's clear that they are really trying to push people further down this continuum toward violent extremism. A lot of people are very clever as they go out in order to preserve their ability to continue to post I think the internet is something that we've had to deal with as parents and as community leaders, because that is an area where there is just so much preying from the standpoint of sexual predators, crime, identity theft, and using it, again, under the cloak of a religious banner for terrorist and extremist ends. I think this is one of the things that community organizations should be sitting down with local representatives of the NYPD or FBI or others to try to have that discussion and dialogue and raise expressions of concern. Before I came here this morning, I had breakfast with Commissioner Kelly, who is terrific, who really has tried to implement a law enforcement policy and environment here that is going to, again, allow people to feel that they can sort of walk through the streets and not feel that they are being singled out. It was nice to hear that you're here in New York and you feel at home, but you go 50 miles outside and all of a sudden it's a different environment. It's because of the richness here. But the issue of extremism and those websites, it's a tough one. And you know, rather than go through sort of which ones I think are bad, I think there's, you know, quite frankly, a lot of exposure in the press right now on some of those and some of those individuals who are just purveyors of violence. Over here. I've exceeded my time. Yes, I know. I'm going to get the
Hi, thank you for being here. My name is Abid Puyan, and I'm a teacher in Brooklyn. One of the things that I'm taught by and kind of forced by my administration at school is to kind of give three takeaway points to my students. What are three things that they should have learned in this 1 hour period? And my question to you, I'm hoping is a simple one, is that President Bush, you know, delivered Ramadan messages to Muslims. He said that we're not at war with Islam, we're at war with Al-Qaeda. Can you give us three specific tangible points that differentiate the Obama administration from the previous Bush administration? And I was hoping in a man in your position, given that you have extensive experience with both administrations, that you'd be able to come up with three in particular. Thank you.
Next question. First of all, I'm neither Democrat nor Republican. I have greatly held on to my nonpartisanship over the years because I consider myself a public servant. And I have served for both Republican and Democratic administrations and have been proud to do that. And I think the previous administration deserves a lot of praise and credit for the work they did after 9/11 as far as making this country safer and stronger. I had differences of view with individuals within the administration on certain policies that were pursued. But I think we can all have honest differences of view on these issues. And you know, I really don't want to highlight sort of what this administration is doing better than the last one. I can tell you some of the things that I feel, in some respects, are different as I go forward in this administration. Number one, I think the engagement with the world is done in a manner that really takes into account the complexities that we're facing. The world is not black and white. It's not divided into good and evil. It is a complex array of countries, cultures, peoples, issues that are very tough to resolve. It's not a game of kinetic checkers. It's more three-dimensional chess. And engaging with President Obama and others, I really feel as though as we try to address the issues in Yemen or Somalia or Iraq or Afghanistan, the appreciation is there for that three-dimensional chess. So that's one. Secondly, I think that is perceived by a lot of people overseas as being a change from the previous administration. One can agree or disagree with the decision to invade Iraq or to go into Afghanistan then after 9/11. But I think there was a perception that gathered worldwide after that invasion of Iraq that really viewed us through a prism that saw military adventurism. Right or wrong, that's the way what the perception was. With this administration, it turns a page. It's a new administration. And I think we've been given the opportunity. And I think that's why the expectations worldwide and within our own communities are so high, because things happened after 9/11, some absolutely necessary, some debatable. But we have a history there. But now we have a new chapter. And I feel that engagement with certainly a lot of my foreign partners, the willingness to partnering with the United States now, is something that they seek. And then third would be the president really does take as seriously as any other president his obligation to protect the security and safety of the American people. Every day he wants to make sure we are as proactive and aggressive on that. At the same time, though, he very much views these issues and these decisions that we take through that prism of our values as a nation. And, you know, and I'm not going to address at all the previous administrations, you know, the previous administration had people in it that were as committed to the values that they held very high. But the dedication to civil liberties, dedication to the rule of law, dedication to making sure that we're not going to overreact, that we're going to do things because it's the right thing to do. And I think anybody who's watched what's happened in Washington over the last year recognize that, you know, this administration has its political detractors. And, you know, politics, you know, can be a really rather tough environment. And that's why I've tried to stay away from it. But the president has said to me and to others, good policy ultimately will give you good politics. Don't let the politics drive you. Let the good policy drive you. Do what is right, and hopefully then the politics will follow and the American people will understand exactly why. So I feel that this administration, this president, is really trying to do the right thing, but in very choppy waters. Choppy, I'm not just talking about the political environment, but they are choppy, but the international environment. We have countries that are aspiring for nuclear weapons. We have countries that continue to suppress and repress their people. We have countries that are led by individuals who are corrupt. We have continued problems of not dedicating the resources necessary to give people the opportunity to educate themselves, become literate, and to be part of their society and the world economy. These are really tough challenges. I'm just thankful that we have people who still want to be president of the United States. A couple more, right here. Someone's coming. Then we'll do the person behind you, and then we'll pick one more for the last bank shot.
Thank you so much. My name is Kyathi Joshi, and I'm an associate professor. I teach in the School of Education at Fairleigh Dickinson University, your old stomping grounds.
FDU, right.
FDU, yes. In Bergen, yeah. County. And, this gentleman spoke so eloquently about essentially how religion is racialized. People see brown folks, and they don't know the difference between Sikhism, Hinduism, Islam. And I know the teachers I teach and that I've been working with for the past 10 years, and many of them are frightened to talk about religion in schools. And while we have the First Amendment, and while we have justices who've said we need to have religion taught about in schools, I'm wondering if in these days, especially after 9/11, if the Department of Homeland Security could be a little more proactive perhaps. Are they, and maybe we just don't know it, working with the Department of Education and thinking a little more about being upstream, as you were talking about, and encouraging teachers from the federal at the federal level to really think about religion, different cultures, because right now that there's no real emphasis on that because of testing and evaluation and measurement and things of that nature. And we know that the education piece will really help.
I agree with you. And the White House has been trying to orchestrate over the past several months an interagency effort that can address this issue of education and how it's going to be furthered and implemented, because we don't want to have, again, the counterterrorism folks who are running that. It really has to be part and parcel of an education process that tries to take that into account and allows people to have that exposure and understanding of different cultures and relations. Although it may seem like this administration has been in place forever, it's only 13 months. And although that may sound like a long time, sometimes the Washington bureaucracy takes a little bit of time to sort of get going. But I have seen some tangible progress over the past couple of months to try to bring those elements together with the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Education, and others. So that's the direction they're going. It has to be part of that education process and not appended to it by that counterterrorism law enforcement community. Yes, sir. Sorry I didn't get you before.
My name is Javed Tarek. I'm with the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. We are organizing the New York cab drivers. The thing is, In New York City, there are more than 100,000 cab drivers, and there are 75% are Muslims, especially from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and North Africa, and Arab countries. Even though in 911, New York cab drivers played a great role to help public, bringing injured people to the hospital free, and all day long they were helping the public. We face a new kind of racism after 911. And right after that, a lot of cabs got vandalized, and Muslim cab drivers, even though our Sikh cab drivers who has beards and turbans for a wrong identity, they were got beaten. And still, we are facing daily basis harassment and by the public when they see our name written on our license. So we are taking precaution and also fighting on local base with the regulator agency that they should not put our name on our hack license, even though we have our number is enough. And the second thing, for this harassment and this assault, we are fighting in a state base to pass legislation that harassment against cab driver should be a felony. And I think if we take this kind of precautions all over in America, because everywhere in America, there are thousands of cab drivers, and most of the cab drivers are 75% are Muslim, are facing this kind of harassment, right. And that can prevent this kind of racism.
Right. You know, as you were talking, I was just thinking, throughout the world, I don't think there's not a single country where similar types of prejudice and discrimination and harassment take place. You know, look in, you know, South Asia between, you know, Hindu and Muslim communities, you know, Southeast Asia and Indonesia between, you know, Christian and Muslim communities, or in the Balkans between different types of ethnic groups and nationalities. It is endemic to the world that you're going to have environments and situations where some people just are naturally prejudiced. What I find, though, also interesting is that people here are particularly outraged because that type of harassment and prejudice is so inconsistent with what this country stands for. Our expectations are so high. People, when they come to the United States to live, to visit, to work, they have this image of the United States as being this great, powerful country where all these other problems that we had to leave our home countries and flee, they're not going to be here. Well, we've brought from all those countries, those people, we've brought a lot of those prejudice and discriminations and history and baggage here to this country. We'd like to think that the environment here is going to melt us within this pot so that we can live next to one another. And we want to keep our expectations high. We want to always be frustrated and annoyed with these things because they are inconsistent with that document that anchors us as a people, where it says all men and women are created equal. It's going to take us a while to get there. It really will. And, you know, it's not going to be in my lifetime. It's not going to be in my children's or grandchildren's lifetime. But if we continue to work and every day and push this, I think we can make progress. And we're making progress on a daily basis. But sometimes we can't measure it in a day. But let's take a step back and say, well, we've come a long way. Let me go back there. I'm going to have to, I'm sorry, I'm exceeding my welcome here, but I could do this all day. It's really, in some respects, very good to be out of Washington.
Well, thank you so much for being here. My name is Asad Akhtar. I'm actually a staffer on Capitol Hill and president of the Congressional Muslim Staff Association. The question I have for you is a little bit outside of your direct purview, but I hope you can address it. Dealing with the Department of Justice and others, you know, you talk about the media and labels. There's a label put on many Muslim organizations that address it, and it's that of unindicted co-conspirator. It's the title that for those who know legally means nothing as far as any terrorism-related charges or even suspicion of terrorism, but is a label that allows media, both legitimate and less legitimate, to smear the community and to smear organizations and not allow organizations to take hold. A similar issue with, you talked about Muslim charities with the Department of Treasury, as far as Muslim charities and the inability for the community to really donate with confidence. The president address this in Cairo, I believe, in taking steps, but it's still an issue. And the reason I just find it so critical is because you're here and asking the community here to be empowered, to step up, and we want to be empowered and we want to step up. But quite honestly, we're not able to be empowered because at the same time we're being disempowered by these labels from the government, which I would hope that the Obama administration would take a strong role in trying to eliminate, because it keeps us from being able to be engaged and to step up as we want to do and as you want us to do for our nation.
Yeah, some of these labels are very dangerous, and they're sometimes too convenient to bucket people conveniently within a certain category that allows people to do things. And this is something that law enforcement, justice, are looking at, have taken a step back and are looking at, but this does take some time. You know, what constitutes a suspected terrorist? Well, it can be quite an array of things. You know, someone who, if you know that someone is a terrorist, and you're watching them, and they live with somebody, and they work with them, and they're with them all day, and they are constantly communicating, but yet you don't have the information on them, well, that's pretty good as far as being a suspect. But then you have other people that are further away from that individual that might also be labeled the same way. And that type of sweeping mentality, I think, is very detrimental, and we need to take a look at that. This needs to be recalibrated, just like we're recalibrating secondary screening, no-fly lists, other types of things. I think that is important. On the issue of contributions and charities, Zakat, I can remember when I was a kid, my father used to take me up to 232nd Street, Gaelic Park, a place where Irish hurling and football was played. And this was in the 60s and early 70s when the IRA was engaged in all the terrorist attacks in Northern Ireland. And there'd be a lot of people outside who were trying to collect money for the widows and orphans. And I remember my father pulling me along. I said, "Dad, let's give money to them." And my father, who, you know, sort of was from that community, he knew exactly who was collecting for the widows and orphans and who were just using the widows and orphans as a ploy to get money to go to buy weapons, hand grenades, explosives. We need to make sure that we as a community, and I think this is where a real obligation falls in this community, is not to allow us to be entrapped by those who purport to be Islamic, purport to endorse moderation, but are using just that banner as a way to funnel funds. It is a challenge, and I think this is something that the government is going to have to sort of deal with, but I think the president has been very sort of strong in some of his statements about the importance of allowing those types of contributions going to those legitimate organizations, whether they be Muslim, Hindu. Yes, you have a follow-up?
Cleared list, work with us directly so that we know with confidence that we can invest. Same thing with our organizations. If there's somebody who's supporting terror, we want nothing to do with them. But we need a direct conversation to know who to work with and who not to, because when you use labels like unindicted co-conspirator, we dismiss it offhand. And so we want to work with confidence with you directly to know who is and where there's legitimate evidence that someone really is or charity really is going to the wrong places, and where it's just really quite honestly, you know, not true, and where it's just, yep, you know, quite honestly being used to smear our community.
Well, the Department of Justice and Treasury are trying to work, and it, you know, the pendulum that swung after 9/11, it swung very much in one direction, swinging back, but does take some time. I think it is still going there, but I think that engagement with the community, as you say, is really important. Two more. This time it's really two more. This is the next to last one.
Hi, my name is Omar. I'm a graduate student at Columbia University. A couple of people brought up the issue of airport security, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on that. We know for obvious reasons why religious and ethnic profiling doesn't work in terms of maintaining the security of our country. But this, I'm wondering what the conversation is right now in our government about the issue of national profiling and the new list that was introduced of countries where citizens who are from those countries can be subjected to special screening. I'm wondering whether you really believe that makes us safer. Nigeria was added to the list. Cuba's on that list. But as we know, back in 2006, more than one individual who was a British citizen was involved in plotting against the United States via transatlantic airliners. So why don't we subject all British citizens to the same kind of logic. And this is quite apart from the offense that it may, or inconvenience it may cause to people of Muslim background or who appear Muslim. And it's also beyond the issue of just looking at names that sound Muslim. So I'm wondering what the conversation is in the government about this issue and what they think will actually make us safer.
There is an ongoing and active dialogue. I've spoken with the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security on the process that we have underway right now as far as the review of this list of 14 countries. There are issues related to the secondary screening, the mandatory secondary screening of those 14 countries, and then there's issues about adjusting the criteria, the guidelines as needed for the watch list or no-fly lists. They're related, but they are distinct. The countries that were put on there, combination of reasons, some that are state sponsors of terrorism, some because there are still outstanding requirements as far as information sharing, as far as passenger lists, other types of things, or the security that exists within airports and enhancements that are need to be made, or countries where there is a very active terrorist presence, or countries where intelligence provides us insight into where the next Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab may come from. And again, in the overabundance of caution that, and I remember the discussions that took place, we recognized that there was going to be a fair amount of pushback. I said, okay, do I mind really receiving a lot of that criticism and those phone calls more than I mind a plane with 300 innocents plummeting to the ground? Because in the aftermath of Abdulmutallab, we still were, you know, concerned about others who might try that same type of attack. We enhanced security, we enhanced the number of federal air marshals on flights, but we have a layered defense, and some actions were taken. But I can assure you that this has been almost a daily conversation to move very smartly, and the next time we sort of recalibrate this rheostat here on, you know, which countries and the procedures, that it's done the right way. We don't want to whipsaw people. But a lot of times when they have these types of attacks or attempted attacks, there's going to be a reflexive action, and that's where national security will be pushed up because of the concern about a potential near-term threat. Let's go over here. I haven't been there. Yes, sir. Here, and then the woman in the back, and you're the last one out there. But first we'll do the man here. So I couldn't stay just up to.
Thanks so much. I think, first of all, I think we all really appreciate you being here as the first step. And second thing is, I am, my name's Josh Martin. I worked for a few years with the American Society for Muslim Advancement on the Upper West Side. I'm also a former Israeli soldier. And I want to give you a second chance to answer the question about Israel.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of people are similarly feeling as I do, that the question needs a little bit of a deeper consideration. And I think, speaking for myself as well as others, you know, I think we come here looking, you know, first of all, I think everyone is on your side. I think everyone is a strong supporter of the new approach that Obama has brought to the Office of the Presidency, to the administration, and the government of the country, and the influence that America has in the world. And I've heard people in the administration as well say that the main challenge to America's security and foreign policy is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Sorry. so it is an issue of passion. I think we all understand that it may be a little bit unreasonable to expect from the American administration, given the political winds that exist, to withdraw any kind of support from Israel. But I think, or at least to withdraw it, in a wholesale manner, politically and ideologically. But with that said, I mean, I think I wonder to the extent that we can use certain tools in a practical way to get a stronger measure of fairness and ultimately a greater chance for resolution to the conflict by using certain tools like the withdrawal of funds as levers on Israel to change some of its political approaches. So I wonder if you could speak directly to that issue, and again, just to give you a second chance to express that, because I think we're all very disappointed in your first answer.
Well, I'm sorry I disappointed you with my first answer. I'll try again. Clearly, the Israeli-Palestinian issue is one that is at the forefront of the president's mind. It's one that he continues to work at, and engages with both Palestinians and Israelis to see if we can advance. You raised the issue about using the levers that the United States has as far as assistance or whatever to move this. And I think what you're pointing toward is our being able to use these levers with Israel in terms of foreign assistance, military, economic assistance, whatever else. You know, I've been involved in a number of different foreign policy matters over the years, including some negotiations from an intelligence standpoint and supporting those. And I think one of the ingredients of any successful movement is that the parties really need to want to move and agree to move and not be forced to move. If they're forced to move before they believe that they are ready, things will fall apart. They'll find other reasons or to not continue to advance the ball. But there is a delicate balance between being forced to move and being pressed and encouraged to move. And President Obama, I think, when he looks at these issues, he's trying to make sure that the United States can use all of its influence, all of its power of diplomacy and might, to get parties to move close together, recognizing that it's in their national security interest to do that. But if you push somebody to do it, sometimes things collapse. You need to bring not just one person or one party, you need to be able to bring a body politic, you need to bring a people forward. So I know it's sometimes easy to think that, boy, if we just, you know, told Israel we're going to cut its aid by 50% or 25% or something and not go forward, all of a sudden it's going to sort of open up this and Israel is going to say, oh, okay, yeah, sure. No. Israel has some very, very legitimate security needs and requirements. And there are issues on the Arab and Palestinian side that need to be addressed appropriately so. And so this is something that is not just one party. It's Israel, it's the Palestinians, it's the surrounding countries, Arab, and it's also the international community. This is a complex march. Talking about this is much more than three-dimensional chess. This is, you know, 12-dimensional chess, mahjong, backgammon, and other. There are so many different moves here. And sometimes people are frustrated, and I think the expectations, again, were very high with President Obama coming in. He has worked tirelessly to do this. And part of our conversation yesterday was addressing this issue. What are we going to be able to do? Because these are problems that continue to feed others. So, I'm sure that maybe my second answer was as disappointing as my first. But my only point is that these are complex issues that do not lend themselves to easy solutions. Otherwise, over the past, 43 years or so, we would have been further along here. That's where the perseverance really needs to come in. Okay, the woman in the back, the last question.
Thank you. My name is Linda Sarsour. I'm the director at the Arab American Association of New York. And I just wanted to point out a lot of us sitting in this room are privileged. We haven't seen a lot of the ramifications of the policies that our government puts on our communities, but many of us work and are dedicating our lives to helping our communities understand their rights and working with government agencies that don't necessarily always want to work with us. And you asked us to be ambassadors, and I try to do that on a daily basis, but I need your help to be an ambassador. And I wanted to just give you some examples, things that you've mentioned that really give me a hard time to put a face to the American government or a good face to the American government, which include infiltration of mosques, which has been an issue for us in our community. I mean, it's infiltration of mosques is conducted according to a secret policy that's been never been debated openly. And as a matter of fact, at one point, Congress prohibited it when they were trying to stop domestic spying. NSEER's program since 2003, national organizations, both Muslim, non-Muslim, have been trying to close this program. The program is still open. Our community members continue to have notices to appear. The TSA guidelines, backlogs in immigration, our community members are applying for citizenship so they can become participatory in our civic engagement, and they're waiting for 4 or 5 years because their name is on some list somewhere that the FBI can't get to give them a clearance. The horrific conditions of our immigration detention centers, the unnecessary deaths that happen in our immigration centers because they're run by private entities and there's no accountability by the government. Profiling, I mean, the Patriot Act is now going to be reauthorized as part of a job creations bill with no open debate or opportunity for amendments. Looking at cases of Fahid Hashmi, Afia Sadiqi, Siraj Mateen. These are things that are happening every day in our community. And for us to be our ambassador, we need the information. We need to know what the tactics, what's going on in the administration that's trying to solve some of these issues. I personally haven't seen any of that. I mean, I appreciate your comments. I agree with everything that you're saying. But we also demand trust and cooperation. We also have an open door policy. As you've said, in many of the cases that you've seen, we as community members, family members have come to the government and said, these are the problems that are happening, help us or help these people. So the fact that we're open and our national organization are open in denouncing terrorism, we expect for the government to come through our front door, not through our back doors. So if you can help us be better ambassadors by providing us with information on what the particulars are, or what are the strategies to end NCRs or to look at the TSA guidelines, that would be really helpful for our community members.
Thank you. I think that's an appropriate question or a series of questions to end on, because I think you brought it back to that strategic level as far as all these different policy areas that really need to be addressed as a nation. And when you said that you need to know, in order to be good ambassadors, where we are on these issues, I think you've hit a number of very critical ones as far as what we want to be our policies as a nation as we go forward. You know, I talked about we want to optimize national security and civil liberties, and saying that they're not, you know, we can do both. Well, that's true, but there is tension there. There is tension about what policies we're going to have at our ports of entry as far as secondary screening, what types of policies we're going to have in our local community about engagement with law enforcement and what law enforcement should be allowed to do. What are the parameters of those activities by government that need to be established that can ensure the protection of civil liberties, but yet still optimize and safeguard our national security? And these are all very appropriate. And I think now that we are 9 years plus from 9/11, this is the time that I think this country needs to take that step back and have that public discourse. Because these are policies and issues that really should not be decided in the back room or in offices within the White House, not being informed by that public debate. This is why when I look to the Congress and their very important role in our democracy, to have that public debate and to look at the policies that they need to follow through on and enact, and not look at individual cases and second guess what happened at a particular time in a particular day in a particular city, but to look at what should those policies be that will govern what we do as we go forward. So I think it's critically important that we continue to have this engagement and discussion. We're not there yet. I can't say that, you know, today, a snapshot in time, we have this system, you know, exactly the way we want. No. This will be constantly need to be refined and needs to evolve, consistent with who we are as a people. But keeping in mind that if you don't have security, if you don't have that type of peace and confidence that as you walk through the streets, you're not going to be hit with a suicide bomber, then all of this other stuff really can fall by the wayside, because if you can't experience it, why try to promote it? But what we need to do is to make sure that we remember what we are as a country and, again, the foundations that this country was built on. So I really would like to say I very much appreciate this opportunity to talk with you here today. This is something that I think just by your presence here, it demonstrates to me that you are dedicated to doing this as a person, because you're, like me, an American who wants to ensure that not just our security is promoted, but that this dialogue takes place and enriches each one of us. We're not there yet, but as long as, in my view, as long as President Obama remains at the helm, we're going to continue to do our absolute level best every day to ensure that our people are safe and secure and that our civil liberties are protected. So, shukran jazilan, wa alaka, and I will see you at some future gathering. Thank you very much.